A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, excited to be back again with another gem of a podcast. This episode is with Deb Gabor. Now, Deb is the best-selling author of Brandon is Sex, which is a very, very interesting title, and I loved what she had to say about that. And what we talked about today was really interesting. We talked about the importance of branding, as the title suggests, but why it's important to own your story and really have that point of differentiation, and also the idea of how to show up and articulate your value. You know, some of the things we talked about are the interesting trends we've noticed with corporations all over the world who seem to be out of touch with the people that they actually serve, whether it's Pepsi, whether it's Uber, or various hair companies that have sort of been tone deaf. And we dove into why that is and how we can move away from that. It was really, really interesting. She's got an amazing background. Her work spans across several industries, and there's no way you're not going to get value from this. So I'm really excited to have this episode really interact with your airwaves. I just said that. Anyways, enjoy the episode. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of value from it, and go out and make an impact.
In a world where very few people embrace their global identity and seek to understand their neighbors, cross-cultural expert Tayo Roxon is on a mission to bridge this divide. Each week, he'll open your mind with insights from some of the global minds in the world. Get ready, take some notes, and learn how to be the best you that you can be.
Welcome to another episode of As Told by Noise. Today's guest is Deb Gabor. She is the CEO of Saul Marketing and the best-selling author of Brandon is Sex. What is Saul Marketing, that you ask? It is a brand strategy consultancy that has led brand strategy engagements for organizations ranging from international household names like Dell, Microsoft, and NBC Universal to digital winners like All Recipes, Cheeseburger, HomeAway, Retail Me Nut, and dozens of early stage tech and digital media titans. So basically, she's someone that knows how to deal with the new as well as the old, and she is an expert on branding and figures, you know, that her title will be Brandon is Sex, because I'm now curious about why Brandon is Sex, Deb. Welcome to the show.
Okay. Well, it's interesting how we came to the title of the book being Branding is Sex. And really, I believe that the job of all brands is to make their customers feel like the heroes in their own lives. And when you feel heroic and you feel like you have the world on a string and you can accomplish anything, not only do you feel great about yourself and, you know, maybe you feel a little sexy, but you actually want to have sex. So it's kind of a metaphor for the feeling that the best brands in the world can give their users through use of the brand. So the brands can bond with people, not just in a cognitive way, but more importantly, in an emotional way. And so Branding as Sex is kind of a shortcut. It actually came from my business. I've been doing this kind of work for longer than I would admit. And I worked with a lot of technology companies. Worked with a lot of companies that were decidedly unsexy. But one of the things that usually opened up people's thinking and got them to really think about their brand inclusive of their customers was to just ask the question, hey, how does this brand get your customer laid? And that would open up all kinds of conceptual territory for folks who normally weren't thinking about how their brands could bond with customers in an emotional way. So it was about the only title that we could use for this particular book. And so the book, it has a cheeky title. It is not about sex. It just has a cheeky and sexy title. There's really good business value within, and it's kind of a how-to book.
Well, I have no doubt. Well, before we get into that, I'm kind of curious. How did you get into this world of branding? What did you do as a kid that made you turn that light bulb on and say, I need to work with brands and I need to be a consultant.
Yeah, you may relate to this. My parents were immigrants and also like very, very cheap. And we didn't have a lot of brand name stuff when I was growing up. And we were sort of brandless or, you know, unbranded, if you will, a lot of generic stuff. You know, my dad drank the beer that came in the white can with the black label that just said beer on it. And, you know, things like that. And so, like, I grew up in this household where I was aware of brands and I saw brands around me, but they were something that were like really, really out of reach. And I think in a way that prepared me for a life where I didn't take it for granted. And then, you know, fast forward to, many years later when I was a grown up and getting a job, my very first job out of college, I worked for one of the biggest brands in the world, which was AT&T. And I worked there at a time that was, you know, that was pretty exciting because the telecommunications and data communications industry was growing and developing. And one of the first assignments that I got to work on while I was there was an Olympic sponsorship, an Olympic partnership and sponsorship. AT&T used to be like a huge sponsor of the Olympics. And I got to really understand, you know, things like consumer branding and brand associations, brand awareness, and started, you know, really to just kind of become obsessed with it. And then thereafter, every job that I had when I worked in the industry was, you know, as a brand manager or a brand leader or product marketing person where brand was really important. And then I moved to the agency side of the business and worked for a couple of agencies managing brand strategy engagements for other clients. And then it was just sort of like a runaway train because I'm a terrible employee. I had to start my own company back in 2003 where I could do this for other people. So I think it, you know, the roots were in, you know, this family life when I was growing up where, you know, brands were around, but we didn't have them. So they seemed like this incredible mystical thing. And I looked at them, you know, almost under a microscope. And then now I'm just obsessed with them. I tell people I was born to brand. I can't not do it. I can't not think about it. I can't not talk about it when I get together with other business people.
No, thank you so much for sharing. And a lot of, you know, the main reason I ask that question all the time is because most times I've asked that question, a lot of the roots of what people do now can be traced back to things that were interesting to you as a child. And, you know, you talked about your observation with, you know, your dad, sort of getting the generic brands like, you know, a bottle with beer as the, as the title. And I think those things happen to a lot of people if they truly end up figuring out how to follow the drive and passion. And, you know, it's interesting that you turned that experience into a career, even though you probably weren't. I don't know if you were consciously doing that, but it sounds like your natural instincts led you down that path.
Yeah, it definitely was not a conscious thing, I have to tell you. And yeah. I never set out to start a company either. Exactly. It was just one of those things where I couldn't not do it. And I started doing it kind of on a freelance basis. And then all of a sudden, there was this incredible demand for what I was doing in the unique way that I was doing it. And then I woke up one morning and I had a company. So, I never imagined that it would become this and that I would be, you know, running this entrepreneurial venture and doing all these incredible things like writing books and traveling all over the world and speaking to big groups of people and doing interviews and stuff like that. It's just interesting how things can pick up momentum when you love them.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So since we are talking about branding, how would you describe your personal brand?
Let's see. Well, my personal brand really is this, you know, branding is sex brand. That's kind of how it's developed over the years. It's just kind of my unique approach and the I'll call it like the enthusiastic way that I approach branding from this, you know, emotional point of view. It's funny because a creative director I worked with many, many years ago, he anointed me with the title Brand Dominatrix. And so, you know, it's a funny title and it's interesting in today's kind of hashtag Me Too world. Like, you know, what is the role of a title like that? It really sort of makes me think, but that's always been part of my personal brand, which is kind of, you know, tell it like it is, in your face. I'll tell you the pure, unvarnished truth about things. I'm all about driving people to, you know, unlock whatever kind of latent potential they have in their business through connecting with customers in an emotional way. Sometimes that requires me to be pretty hardcore. So, but you know, it's a, I feel like it's a pretty strong, consistent brand. Over the last couple of years, I've become the world's resident authority on botched corporate apologies, which is interesting. And I think that's kind of part of my brand, but, that's how I would describe it. I mean, it really permeates everything I do in my life, whether that's an interview like this, or I'm working hands-on with clients, or I'm speaking to a large group of CEOs, or, you know, even as I move through my personal life, it's hard to separate my obsession with branding and brand strategy from my personal life even.
No, I'm a fan of when careers end up being personal and professional. I think it's one of those things that ends up working well if you actually do it with heart, and it seems like you do that as well. But speaking of corporate apologies, 2017, 2018 has been the year where interesting companies that have big names, whether they're startups or established companies, have made some pretty big corporate blunders, whether it's Pepsi, whether it's Uber, whether it's H&M recently. or a lot of the hair companies, you know, who tend to forget that they have people of color as customers as well. So I'm curious, you know, when you observe this as a leadership branding, you know, expert, how would you even have advised them to recover? What should the CEOs do at that point?
Yeah, there's so many brands. If you look back, 2017 was, in the branding world, was marked by really two huge trends. One of them was sort of social advocacy, if you will, which is associating your brand with a social cause or with, you know, with a movement or something. And then the other side of it was just sort of like big brand blunders. And some of them were intertwined. You know, you brought up Pepsi. That was probably the first big one of 2017, where their internal film, the little film that they produce with their internal content group within Pepsi, featuring Kendall Jenner, that seemed to appropriate the Black Lives Matter movement, and, you know, it was just completely whitewashed, and she definitely was not the right person to have associated with something. I mean, I think their intention was good, but it just really, really fell with a thud. Pepsi, actually, they handled it pretty well. I mean, you know, the fact that it got produced and it went out the door looked to me like there were a bunch of lawyers involved rather than, you know, really good-hearted creative people. But when they, you know, when they did, I think the commercial maybe aired, I think it aired just online, and for not very long before they pulled it down, as soon as they started experiencing the backlash. I think they did everything right in terms of apologizing. The fact that it was made in the way that it was made in the first place, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, the screw up, they handled it okay, in that they pulled it down, they issued an apology, you know, they said, we're not going to do this again. They definitely showed some regard for, you know, people's feelings and humanity, and they acknowledged their mistake. Fast forward to a little bit later that week, United Airlines, and this was the same week.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I mean, this was a career-making week for me as far as corporate apologies goes. When United Airlines pulled that poor guy off of an airplane, you know, right or wrong, you know, what that guy's involvement was and what he did, what he said, it was shocking to not only, you know, not only this poor man who was physically injured, but other people who were on the plane, but the rest of us who were watching this story unfold in social media in almost real time, right? And they really, like United Airlines, really screwed up in a multitude of ways. One of them being, you know, they waited more than 48 hours before issuing any kind of apology. The apology was like a 140-character tweet that didn't seem to have any apology. It was sort of like one of those hashtag sorry not sorry apologies, which looked to me like it was written by a bunch of attorneys. It didn't have any regard for humanity. It did not express, you know, any sort of condolences or bad feelings, or, you know, any kind of fast forward to, you know, here's what we're going to do to prevent this from happening in the first place. So, you know, there was that. And then they actually, you know, beyond Beyond that, the CEO issued a statement a couple of days later that was very poorly constructed, and then they were silent for a long time. You know, and the big issue there is an organization that their brand is supposed to be fly the friendly skies, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, if truly your brand is fly the friendly skies, you shouldn't anoint every single person in the organization all the way down to the gate agent with the power to do not just the best they can, but whatever it takes to ensure that every single customer has a friendly skies experience on their plane. And the situation there, if you remember, was the flight was oversold and they were looking for some people to get off the plane. Well, the gate agent was only authorized to go up to a certain amount in terms of offering people to get off the plane. I know I have a limit, and it's not $300. It's probably closer to $1,000, and I'm sure that there were other people there. But if people were really empowered to deliver on the promise of the brand, that gate agent or whomever was, you know, in charge that day, who was like a rank-and-file employee, would have been bestowed with the power to do not just the best they could, but whatever it takes to prevent something like that from happening. So that's an example of, you know, of a company that just did everything wrong. And then, you know, also in 2017, we had organizations like Uber, which Uber, like, they couldn't stop themselves
couldn't.
Right? They just couldn't stop themselves from getting in trouble. Everything from, you know, just being completely emblematic of everything that we love to hate about Silicon Valley bro culture to, you know, just like some downright dirty dealings. And, you know, that's a brand. It's fascinating to me, you know, where they're going today. And everything that they did that was a misstep, they had like a counter step for that, but then it became a misstep. It's just they can't seem to do anything right. But then, you know, it's interesting because this, you know, back to the idea of brands being social advocates and brands actually aligning themselves with social issues and causes and people and things like that. I mean, fast forward, the big story right now this week, and you and I talked about this before this interview, you know, the brands that are severing ties with the National Rifle Association, right, you know, coming out of the shootings in Florida last week. So, I think it's a trend that's going to continue. And in today's world where we have always on 24-hour a day media, you know, it's going to become increasingly important for brands to really identify who are their core customers, what are their core customers' values and beliefs, and then, you know, do what they can to align with them through their actions as brands. I know that was like a very long answer to a short question.
I just
kind of rambled on.
I think it's very important to a lot of us, you know, you're involved in this world and a lot of us to see, you know, we have a lot of questions when we hear these things and you just gave us a nice behind the scenes. The other thing that you touched on though was how did these decisions get made? So I run a diversity and inclusion firm, right? And as a speaker and consultant, I do a lot of speaking on communication, leadership. And, you know, companies bring me in to sort of prevent what happens, like with H&M and all these things, because they're like, we need to figure out our biases. We need to figure out our inclusivity with this. We want to make sure that we're creating equal opportunities for people so that they can feel seen, heard, and understood. But when, you know, commercials go out where, you know, a white person can take off a shirt, or a black person can take off a shirt, she becomes a white person, or like their appropriation of, you know, of Black Lives Matter in that way happens. And it's, this is like big companies. Is it that the people up there that are making decisions just don't have any person of color to say, hey, you know, this might not fly the way you think it is? Because it almost sounds like that's them being out of touch with the audience they're trying to serve.
Yeah, I do think that a lot of that has to do with just being out of touch. You know, I can't really speak to like what is the makeup, you know, the demographic makeup of the leadership in these firms. I can tell you that, you know, brand culture and the way brands show up in the world, it starts at the top of the organization. So, you know, the CEO and the executive team and, you know, that it's their responsibility to make sure that brands are in touch with who their audience is and make sure that they have a presence that is definitely reflective of that audience. And, you know, it definitely is the responsibility of the leaders at the highest level of the organization to ensure that their brand includes their customers. I always say, like, you know, one of my big mantras is brand or be branded. You have a brand whether you like it or not, and your brand isn't about you. Your brand is about your customers. And if you are out of touch with your customers and you do not represent your entire customer base, then your brand is going to fail on delivering on its promises. And, you know, people ask me, they're like, whose responsibility is branding? Is it just the brand manager? Or is it just advertising? Is it the ad agency? Is it just the creative people? Is it just the salespeople? No, it's every single person within the organization. Uber is a really good example of an organization that, you know, from the founder on down, that was a brand that shows up in the world as a brand that has a sick culture through and through. So, you know, what you're describing, you know, some of these things that maybe just look like advertising missteps, they in many cases are emblematic of a brand that's like sick all the way through. And when a brand is not in touch with reality and not in touch with their customers, it's a sick brand. I mean, I had a client once, some of the work that we do, we actually do a lot of research for our clients. And some of the work we do involves going out and doing what we call video ethnography, where we actually sort of experience what is it like, you know, a day in the life of our customers. And we recruited a bunch of this company's actual customers to participate in this research. And every day they came to a platform online and they did assignments and they showed us videos of themselves shopping and of themselves talking and stuff like that. Many of the people in those videos were people of color, and the CEO of this company, and I won't mention any names or anything. The CEO of this company, when we were reviewing this research, including, you know, highlight reels from these video clips that we frankly were really excited to share, you know, like, hey, this is really great. For the first time ever, you're going to actually see what it looks like inside your customers' homes, right? You know, they saw, like, out of the 30 or so interviews that we did, that many of those people, they were people of color, and they were people who didn't look like who they thought their customers were. That CEO asked me, he said, those are not our customers. I said, they sure as heck are your customers. We recruited them directly from your customer database. And actually, some of these customers, the ones that you're looking at that you say are not your customers, because they don't look just like your wife, some of those customers are not just your customers. They're your best customers. We recruited them to participate in this research because they were frequent high volume buyers from you. And it's stunning to me how easy it is for the leadership of an organization to get completely out of touch with who their customers really are.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was thinking of. And because, I mean, to us, it does appear that way, like outside on the, we're not in, the, you know, in the industry. But yeah, I mean, it honestly is out of touch, but it's also, I honestly feel like if you do have people with different voices on the decision-making level, there's no way that kind of stuff wouldn't just get passed on. It's just because someone would say, hey, that's kind of offensive to me. What are you doing?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. And, you know, I mean, you obviously know this, but diversity of thought and diversity of experience is so important to creating a rich legacy for your company and for your brand. And I believe that a company's brand and culture are indelibly intertwined. You can't separate the two, and you have to have diversity in thought, and diversity in thought and comes from diversity of experience. It just comes from diversity. And so I think that that's like.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
An absolute must-have in this day and age. I mean, and you can see it, you know, whenever a company like really, really screws up and puts its foot in its mouth, you can probably trace it back to a culture that just isn't where it ought to be as an organization in 2018.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about social media. Now, social media is a way of influencing brand strategies. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like that's a true statement? And if so, which brands are doing it well?
So yes, it is absolutely a true statement. I mean, you know, social media is definitely a key part of like the integrated marketing communication sphere. Now it's becoming increasingly important for brands to engage with customers and their audiences through social media, because this is the way people, you know, people vote with their hearts and minds and their wallets. Social media is a primary way they vote with their hearts and minds, right? And brand sentiment in social media definitely can make or break a brand. I think of a really, really interesting example of like the power of social media in building and supporting a brand that comes from late last summer when the March on Charlottesville happened. So, you know, if you can go back to late 2017, hot summer, I think that was August. And then President Trump, you know, he put his foot in his mouth. And I think that the hashtag that was all over Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, it was hashtag Tiki Torch Nazis. Do you remember this?
I do.
Yeah. And what was really, really interesting was the Tiki brand. So I don't know if you know this. I certainly didn't know this, but the word Tiki Torch, it's a brand name, and it is the flagship product of a great little company in Madison, Wisconsin, called Tiki Brand. And all of a sudden, this little tiny 70 person company in Madison, Wisconsin was like thrust into the international limelight with this hashtag Tiki Torch Nazis, where their flagship product was being associated with something that was very much not something that they stood for as a company. And one of the things that they did really well was they used the power of social media to actually go out and positively assert what their values and beliefs were as an organization. So they went out and, you know, made statements to say like, hey, listen, you know what? We are a company that's about the opposite of what we're being associated with right now. We're a company that's all about backyard, family, summertime fun, and bringing people together and having people together. And they used social media to distance themselves from something that was going to be a negative brand association for them. As a result, the name Tiki Torch and the Tiki brand were top of mind for lots of people for a couple of weeks this last summer. There's no way to calculate the value that brings to that organization. Where social media could have killed that brand, they actually definitely used it for their own advantage by going out and telling a positive story about what their values and beliefs really were in order to bond more customers to them. I'll tell you, the next time I went to Lowe's to, you know, buy stuff for our neighborhood party, like, I was looking for the Tiki branded torches, that was for sure. So, you know, that's the power of social media in terms of being able to tell a story about your organization that is your brand, inclusive of your customers.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story to actually use with that too, because it's one that, I mean, I knew of it, but then I was like, oh wow, I can totally see what you're saying now with the branded. and all that.
Yeah, so I didn't even know that they were like a real company. I just thought that actual, you know, that actual thing, that bamboo pole that you pour the oil into and then you light on fire. I just thought that was like a generic name, like Kleenex and cellophane and Scotch tape and things like that, and Band-Aid have become in our culture. That's not the case. It's actually, you know, it's a company and it's a brand name. And it's a teeny tiny blip on the whole radar of, you know, brand strategy and things like that. But I like it as a case study because, you know, it just shows the power of storytelling, and it shows the power of being an open and authentic and honest communicator through social media, and the benefits that can create. So, you know, social media on the positive side can counteract social media on the negative side, especially when it's not intended.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I 100%. I mean, I know I'm from the generation that loves social media, but I've also always thought that, you know, there are positive aspects of it. And I think a lot of times the negative aspects tend to be focused on more, but I think, it's definitely a lot of things that could come about from using social media the right way. So, I don't know. Just my thought. But what do I know? I'm a millennial.
Yeah, well, you know what? I love the millennials in my business because they keep us connected to, you know, what really is the market level dialogue, what's important to people. They're movers and shakers and influencers, and I think it's really, really important to have millennials in your business, no matter what kind of business you're in. I'm a Gen Xer, I guess, an aging Gen Xer, if you will. And a lot of my business leader colleagues, you know, there's this ongoing conversation about, you know, us versus them or whatever. I actually think it's really important to have people in your organization that shake you up, that make you uncomfortable, that, you know, do things and see things in a completely different way. Because, you know, I know that I don't have all the answers, and the kind of business I'm in, I need people of all generations here who can kind of keep us in touch with, like, what are the trends and what are the issues and how do people behave and, you know, what technologies are they using or not using and how do they like to communicate and how do they like to live their lives? Because, you know, I can't be a good brand strategist unless I have my finger on the pulse of all those things too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. And thank you for saying that. I've always said that. I mean, with the work that we both do, a lot of times, yes, seeing the fact that we're going to be in a generation where five generations possibly going to be in the workforce, you know, I've always straddled between that, you know, dad's a baby boomer, mom's Gen Xer, the youngest brother's Gen Z, me and my middle brother are like the millennials. So it's always interesting living in that type of family, but also having to work with teams to show people that, hey, look, this is not, you can't just run away from this. This is what's happening. And it's not us versus them. We can work together. This is how. And I often have a lot of humorous conversations with different CEOs, because when you get them in private settings, they admit to several interesting things, and it's all based on some fear and some lack of awareness about the generations. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I can't be that fearful. I have an almost 21-year-old daughter. I mean, she scares me to death for like a bunch of other reasons, you know, but you know, I have to be connected to all of those things, or Absolutely. Else, you know, we're not going to relate.
Yeah, no, this is good. So speaking of communication, because we're getting ready to, before we go into the book, you talk about the Amazon effect. What is that to you?
Yeah, the Amazonification of everything, right? That's what I'm talking about right now. Like, is it possible for a company to get too big and infiltrate our lives in so many ways? So, you know, one of the Amazon effect and the Amazonification of the world, it has become increasingly apparent to me how much they're infiltrating my life. I live in Austin, Texas, which is, you know, I am right in the backyard of Whole Foods headquarters. And over this past weekend, I found myself in three separate Whole Foods stores.
Yeah.
Not really sure why, but, you know, for different things. One time I was eating and having a glass of wine. One time I was shopping. And then another time I was shopping. Three different locations. And the Amazonification, like, Amazon owns Whole Foods. And I was waiting to see, like, how is Amazon going to impact my world? Well, now all of a sudden I can get my Whole Foods groceries ordered and delivered to me within 2 hours via Amazon Prime, right? And what's really interesting about this is that, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but Amazon late last summer or early in the fall, they started unilaterally lowering prices of goods sold on Amazon, branded goods sold on Amazon. I don't know if you knew this, but in order to be a seller on Amazon, in many cases, you have to sign up for a lot of things that you maybe don't want to agree to. And that's one of them, is that they have the power to unilaterally reduce your prices. And so they were going through and reducing prices on a lot of branded merchandise. This was about at the same time they were starting to ramp up, you know, what are we going to do with all of these several hundred Whole Foods stores that we have? And so what's going on is, you know, with the Amazonification of the world, they're going to be able to create conditions by which they can give the goods, the products and services that they sell, like more preferential treatment from a pricing perspective. And I think it has the power to completely change the consumer packaged goods industry. They're going to start to gather lots of data about, you know, what brands and products are people purchasing at the point of sale, what are they purchasing online, and then being able to control pricing on branded goods and control the placement on the site and advertising and SEO footprint of goods that are either, you know, product lines that are owned by Amazon or product lines that are sold by Amazon. They're going to be able to control, you know, a large volume of what people buy. And that's fascinating to me. The other trend that I see that's really interesting is stuff like, you know, the connected home, for instance. So over Christmas, the big trend this year was smart speakers, right? When smart speakers right now are a little bit of a folly, and you know, it remains to be seen, like, what is the actual value this is going to provide in people's lives and how is this going to change their lives? One of the primary ways smart speakers are going to start to infiltrate people's lives, and I'm talking about, you know, Amazon Echo and, you know, the Alexa technology underlying that. And there's competitors from Google and stuff like that. And I'm not really sure who's going to win this race. But the interesting thing underlying that is the smart speaker trend is picking up steam. At the same time, mm-hmm. very quietly last year, Amazon acquired a majority stake in the Kenmore brand from Sears. Sears is a failing retailer. They acquired the Kenmore brand, and they announced a plan to deploy that Alexa technology through the Sears connected home appliances. So imagine, if you will, a world where you're sitting on the couch and you say to your Amazon Echo, you say, Alexa, buy me some milk. Alexa is going to be able to tell inside your Kenmore refrigerator what kind of milk you have in there, and it's going to place an order directly on Amazon Prime for some milk and have it delivered to your house, where Amazon then can control, like, the entire experience and can control, like, the goods and services that come as part of that. It's kind of creepy when you think about it.
Yeah. No,
and so it's interesting, like, you know, I triangulate all of these little moves that Amazon makes. And I'm like, oh, this Whole Foods thing is not really about Whole Foods as much as it's about retail and as much as it's about getting a physical store presence in 400-something stores in, frankly, the highest, best, most spendiest demographic areas, right? So that's one piece. Then there's also, like, all this data, and Amazon separately is launching a bunch of private label brands under their own Amazon flag, plus Whole Foods has a bunch of private label brands. And then you look at some of these technology things, like this Kenmore thing. It helps them with two things. One thing that Amazon does not currently do really well is big stuff, like furniture and, you know, really, really, really big goods that have to be shipped. That is something that, you know, for all the things that Sears is and they aren't, that's something that they know how to do. So their acquisition of the Kenmore brand helps them get into, you know, maybe being able to handle big stuff, like physically big stuff, better. But more importantly, you know, this technology partnership where they're deploying that technology through those connected home appliances, you can see, like, there's these little Amazon tentacles, like, reaching into everyone's home and business in all these different ways. And unless you, like, really sit back and look at the big picture, you don't see the whole thing. Now, all these things, of course, it's all conjecture, it's all prediction. You know, I and a bunch of other experts out there, you know, thinking about the Amazonification of the world. But I do think it's a big enough company with enough sort of diversified interests that they really could impact the way we shop, the way we live, eat, drink, sleep, learn, play, all of those kinds of things, just because their impact is so far reaching.
Wow. Yeah. That, I mean, yeah. I'm not sure if I should be terrified or happy about this, but
either. Like, I really don't know. I'm like, what should I think about this? You know, like, I don't know exactly. Yeah. I don't know where I am with that.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. But I'm glad that you were able to educate us on that. Now, I'll be remiss if I didn't just go back to Brandon is Sex. It's such an interesting title. When you were writing this book, what were you thinking? And well, I know you touched about it. You talked about it a little bit, but
what was I thinking?
Well, the title is
Branding and Sex. Get your customer laid and sell the hell out of anything. What do you think I was thinking?
Oh my gosh, this is. I'm trying to think of a way to ask the question. What were you hoping? Maybe that's the better way. What were you hoping that the reader would get from the book, man?
Well, you know, I didn't write the book to sell books. I think the title definitely helps the book sell. But I wrote the book because, you know, like I said at the beginning of this interview, I am compelled to share this information, and it is my purpose to help business leaders unlock financial value in their business. I want to, by the time I'm done with this career, you know, create billions of dollars worth of financial value for other people's businesses by helping them identify and bond with their ideal customers. And one of the best ways to do that is by just giving this methodology away for free. I've been doing this for so long that I felt like this was a really good way at a super low price point, you know, $15.99 on Amazon and, you know, your local bookstore or whatever, for you to get a how-to instruction manual for actually unlocking the potential in your brand. And so what I was thinking was, I can't not do this. I am compelled to do this. I have to do this. And this is one of the best ways that I can do it. I believe that my highest, best purpose to this world, I think besides being a really kick-ass mom, is by sharing this information. And, you know, there are some organizations and people who can afford to spend a couple hundred thousand dollars doing it with my company. There are people who can afford to, you know, do it for a couple thousand dollars. There are people who can afford to do it for $15.99. I just wanted there to be an offering kind of at every price point. And literally, I give the methodology away for free. And I talk about it all the time, and I talk with business leaders always, and I tell them, hey, if you want to do this, it really comes down to answering these three simple questions about your business. The first one being, what does it say about a person that they use your brand? The second question is, what is the singular thing they get from you that they can't get anywhere else, which really speaks to meaningful differentiation? And then the third and most important question, and this is the sex question, is how do you make people feel like a hero in their own story? Because all brands need to be about their customers, and this is a branding methodology that helps you answer those questions so that then you can articulate, you know, what is it that you do when customers use your brand that create these conditions where they can be the hero in their story, and they're the one who gets the guy or gets the girl or whatever.
Nice. Hey, well, ladies and gentlemen of As Told by Nomads, if you want to be the hero in your story, if you want to know what it's like to experience this high that comes from being a branding expert, it's definitely something you should get. And they can get the book where? On Amazon, everywhere books are sold?
Yeah, definitely on Amazon, right? It's the Amazonification of the world.
Like, yeah, your favorite brand.
Not my favorite brand, but it's a brand I'm certainly watching. But, you know, thanks very much for giving it a plug. Yeah, you can get it on Amazon, and it's available in a lot of bookstores as well, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Okay, now this is good. And before we close, I've always said two things, right? So for me, I believe the two of the most important skills in the 21st century are personal branding and cultural competency. That's how I've built my brand, if you will, and that's what I work on with people and companies, individuals. How to, you know, define your personal brand in the world of globalization, digitalization. How to understand effectively how to communicate across cultures. And those are, you know, that's what I love to do. That's my expertise. Do you agree that personal brand is such an important thing that we need to have in this new era?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like I said before, brand or be branded, you have a brand whether you like it or not. And this whole idea of personal branding, like that is about you owning your story that's inclusive of all of the other people that you interact with. I mean, I think the business that you're in and what you're doing is very ahead of the curve. And it's something that's like so incredibly necessary in this world that, you know, is changing rapidly. You know, old forms of leadership and relationships and things like that have all just completely gone away with the advent of technology and, you know, social media and online communication and things like that. And I think that a personal brand, how you show up in the world and how you articulate your value to the world, it is definitely essential to ensuring that, you know, you can fulfill your highest, best purpose to the world. So I love what you're doing and I admire the ways in which you're doing it. And I love this podcast. I listened to a bunch of episodes over the weekend in preparation for this, and I think what you're doing is providing a great service to the world.
Oh wow, thank you. First of all, thanks for listening. Thanks for what you do as well. I mean, I don't think people like me would have a career if there wasn't, you know, if you didn't give us some of your resources, you know, for free as well, because a lot of times, you know, what we learn is through the internet, and sounds like even you've touched the lives of many industries. And that I might not even have known until you said it. So
totally.
So I'm happy to hear that. I always ask my guests this question before they go, and it's my mission statement: use your difference to make a difference. So, Deb, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
Okay. Well, I think my difference, I look at my difference as being, you know, I am a real plain talker, a real straight shooter. You know, I really like to shine a light on the truth of things and whatever. And how I make a difference is by asking lots of questions and shining a light on things that are maybe things that people don't like, they don't. It's like a Pandora's box that maybe they don't want to open because you don't ask questions that you're not comfortable hearing the answer to. And my job is to ask those questions and make people uncomfortable with the answer because it drives them to become a better them. And so that's probably my main difference. It really is just sort of like coming from this background of, you know, we're very practical, pragmatic, Eastern European stock, you know, get stuff done kind of people. And I think that I definitely use that to help other people be better by asking the questions.
Yeah. I think asking the right questions can literally change your life to yourself and to other people. So absolutely love that you do that. Love that you are, you know, making movements left and right. And I also love that you're an amazing mom. So,
well, thanks. Yeah, thanks. Awesome. Yeah. Mutual admiration society for sure.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to Deb Gabor, who is the CEO of Soul Marketing and the author of the best-selling book, Branding is Sex. Make sure you grab your copies. Everything will be in the show notes. And I really hope that you all take to heart everything she has said about what branding is and what it isn't. So, till next time, my fellow nomads, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.